And welcome everyone to another very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, bud?
Not much. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great, actually, because tonight we got another fantastic guest. Joining us tonight for discussion is filmmaker John D. Hancock. John is the director of the 70s horror classic Let's Scare Jessica to Death, the highly acclaimed baseball drama Bang the Drum Slowly with Robert De Niro and Michael Moriarty, Baby Blue Marine with Jan Michael Vincent, the cult classic California Dreaming, family holiday favorite Prancer, the prison drama Weeds with Nick Nolte. His most recent film was The Looking Glass, which was a collaboration between John and his wife, Dorothy Tristan, who, in addition to delivering a superb lead performance, wrote the film's sensitively observed screenplay. This is a film that's right now streaming on Netflix. Everyone should check it out. John's impressive TV credits include Cover Up, Lady Blue, Hill Street Blues, and The Twilight Zone, as well as multiple made-for-TV movies throughout the years. He's also a veteran of the stage, having directed works from Shakespeare to Saul Bellow, as well as versions of Night Mother and Noises Off. He served as the artistic director of the San Francisco Actors Workshop in 1965, later became artistic director of the Pittsburgh Playhouse and the New Repertory Theater in New York City. He's collaborated with famed playwright Tennessee Williams. So this is an extreme honor to have him here as our guest. We're going to talk to him about his work and career and everything else in between. So thanks a lot, John. Total pleasure to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to start with The Looking Glass. Nick and I just both recently got a chance to watch it. Like Nick said, it's on Netflix, so I hope everybody checks it out. Netflix streaming, that is. So I hope everybody checks it out.
Is it also on disc, John? No, DVD, Blu-ray?
Yeah, it is. You can get it on Amazon, yeah.
Yep.
So I've always been fascinated with when husbands and wives collaborate on a film together, particularly when it kind of strokes upon heavy thematic subject matter. I guess I have a bunch of questions, but I'll start off. When did your wife write the screenplay? Was it recently?
More recently? Yeah, it was very recently. We decided we wanted to make a movie and look cast about for a subject, and this one, you know, we wrote Weeds together, and that took like what 8 or 10 years to get on. And we've done 5 or 6 things together. We did, she wrote the, uncredited, she wrote the, revised screenplay for Prancer. And then we did, she wrote A Piece of Eden and Suspended Animation and now this. But yeah, this, took her about 6 months before we were still working on it through pre-production actually. We get along, and I think the secret is that, we liked each other's work before we got involved romantically, so that, there was that respect was there to begin with. And we don't fight, you know, very, very little. The things we've written together, we've done it, I guess when we first started, we worked in the same room, but very quickly we began to pass drafts back and forth. And the rule was, if you were willing to retype it, this was the one where there were IBM Selectrics, right? If you were willing to retype it, you could leave out any lines or to change whatever the other person had done. And it worked well because it was a painless way of someone getting rid of your bad lines without saying, "My God, how could you have written that?" Mm-hmm. They just retyped it without it in. And so I don't know. We just developed a way of working that seems to work really well for us.
Yeah, it's always because it is always interesting when husband and wives collaborate in any sort of artistic process, and people always seem to be very fascinated by those collaborations, especially in movies.
Well, you think, well, don't you ever have time off? You know, I mean, that would be the what people would be concerned. You know, don't you want to like go home and relax? And no, I'm not wild on that. I mean, I like to think about what I'm doing, like all the time in bed, and so I don't know. It just worked for us.
How did you come about casting Grace Tarnow in the lead? Because, or I should say opposite your wife, because she is fantastic in the
Isn't she incredible?
She is amazing.
And I've never, you know, obviously, I mean, not familiar with her, you know, with any other performance. And I'm always a fan of when, you know, I mean, I'm always, there's plenty of movie stars I love, but I can always get invested in a story. When I don't know the face, I have no baggage. So it was, she was just fantastic.
Yeah. And when I look on IMDb, this is her only credit and I can't believe.
No, that. I don't think she even, maybe she played an angel or a snowflake in a Christmas show or something in grade school or something. But yeah, she won a local singing contest, the Hoosier Star Award, right? And in the teen category. And so that was her credit. But we saw, I don't know, 500 or 600 actors over a weekend in the LaPorte, Indiana County Library. And she came in and I think sang for me first. And I thought, oh, this, pay attention to this girl. And then we had her improvise a little and then read, and we just got terribly lucky. I mean, I think she could be a big star. I really do. I think she's a very commercial looking and absolute integrity in her acting. I mean, she's not a faker.
Was there a big rehearsal process with her and your wife?
Yeah, we... All during pre-production, 2 or 3 days a week, Dorothy and I would go and pick her up after her middle school, and take her over. You know, maybe sometimes we would go shopping or have something to eat or something. But mainly, we came to our house and read some scenes and then improvised the scenes, and then it was really a bonding process between Grace and Dorothy, mm-hmm. and. They fell in love on both sides, so that when it came time to work together, it made it easy. It made it easy for them to fight or whatever.
The film has an organic quality to it.
It's not like acting to some way. I mean, Dorothy was so totally playing herself. She didn't feel she was acting. And her feeling for Grace was so parallel to what the script called for, that wasn't acting either, nor Grace's feeling for Dorothy, you know. A lot of that film is improvised, by the way. It's just the two of them. Mm. And they really got into it, and I mean, obviously the dance things and all the stuff with Alice in Wonderland or not, but a lot of the scenes between the two of them are.
And you shot that mainly in South Bend?
Well, in LaPorte, South Bend, and a lot of it's our house.
Okay.
And our garden and our farm. And
yeah.
I mean, we shot, I swore I'd never shoot anything in my own home again, but it was kind of written for there. And I couldn't find any place I liked as well. And just logistically, there's a tremendous advantage in being able to shoot the interiors and the exteriors in the same place. Because if it starts to rain and you have to find a cover set or you have to move the trucks, you lose half the day or a third of the day. It's a very bad thing. But if you can just the whole tricks to making low budget pictures is never move the trucks. Mm-hmm. So it was very advantageous to have the yard. I mean, we always wanted to shoot our garden in our yard, but
yeah, absolutely gorgeous.
The,
I mean,
the inside of the house that we were worried about. Yeah. I'm sorry. What did you ask?
No, it was just, it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the house and the garden, I mean, so photogenic and beautiful. And I couldn't help but notice in the beginning, like, I'm assuming that you're a fan of the Tree of Life.
Oh yeah. Yeah, sure.
Because the opening of your film sort of has a Tree of Life moment with the music and sort of like,
yeah. Actually, you know, it's the same. It's the Smetana's Moldau, right?
Yeah, it's the same piece of music. And a very fast paced, you know, piece of camera movement as you know going through the garden and everything. I was like, oh, okay, so here he's giving a little hat tip to you know Terrence Malick, you know. So we're, I mean, I think that's a great movie. I'm glad to hear you're a fan. It's one of my favorite movies actually of all time.
Oh yeah, yeah, mine too.
Yeah, that leads me to my next question. I was struck by the music that you used in the film, and I was wondering how you decided upon that.
Well, I've used the Moldau in a play. I've used it before.
Okay.
And to me, it was I wished that I wasn't in danger of being thought that I was quoting Terry Malick. Because I thought he used it well too, and I wanted to use it myself, and I felt, what the hell? So it's a piece I played in high school as a violinist. I was the concertmaster in my high school orchestra, and it was in a Bohemian area. So every year we played the Moldau. So it's a very has a long history in my consciousness, but. The rest of the music, a lot of it's by Orville Stober, who is a composer I've worked with. He did the score for that short that I was nominated for, and he did a lot of the music for Bang the Drum Slowly and Weeds and A Piece of Eden. And I mean, he's a composer that I've worked with a lot since I did an off-Broadway play with him in I think 1969. So, and he played the caterpillar. He does that.
Okay.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of the songs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The big one that we repeat over and over is by David Del Tredici. He is a kind of modern composer who refers back to Richard Strauss, and he has a kind of 19th century quality to his modern music. But he wrote a piece that he won the Pulitzer Prize for called Final Alice. He's done, I don't know, 12, 15, 20 pieces somehow related to Alice in Wonderland. It's like an obsession with him. And I just thought the melody of that was so beautiful that I wanted to use it. It's really why I had the play that they do be Alice in Wonderland, because I wanted to use that piece of music.
Wow, that's awesome that he played the caterpillar. I wish I had known that prior. So what?
And he wrote that song. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've had a long working relationship with him then.
Yeah, he did Let's Scare Jessica to Death too. Yeah.
Right.
Was there more people that you've worked your? I don't want to say your entire career with, but that you had collaborated with in the past.
Well, the editor, Dennis O'Connor, was on Weeds and Steal the Sky, that HBO thing. And he did Prancer and worked on A Piece of Eden and Suspended. I mean, as an editor, I've grown to trust and a very valuable collaborator. And the DP is somebody I've done five or six pictures with, Misha Suslov. So, yeah, they're people I worked with. I like to work with the same people.
Right, so it's essentially like you have a family you've created that
collaborate
each time.
Yeah.
It's very cool. It must be very rewarding.
It is. It is, you know. And you feel you have their loyalty, which you don't always feel with a DP. Sometimes they really think they should be directing it. So editors feel they should be directing it too. You know, it's the disease of those functions, right? The guy doesn't know what he's doing. You know, that feeling.
Everybody's got an opinion.
That's negative on the set, right?
And so what I would love to know is, what's, you know, one of the big things about working, you know, with your spouse, is sort of like, how do you direct them? What's it like to direct your wife?
It's very easy. You know, I don't do a lot of directing. I don't talk a lot. I try to cast the right people and trust them and nourish them. And I mean, I do. I mean, I say it a little more. You could be a little this, a little that, you know. But did I direct Grace much? Not much, you know. I mean, I suppose I did during the when we were picking her up after school every day. I said, I remember I was driving with her in the car, and I said, you know, you kind of need to plot how you feel about your grandma here and here and here. She said, yeah, like a progression. Yeah, I said, like a progression, right? You got it. And she did, you know. It was hard for me to tell how she did. You know, acting is puzzling. I mean, it's an irrational process that you try to deal with your mind, but it fundamentally, I think, is beyond rational access. There are people that can do it and people that can't, and maybe the people that can do it, you might help them be a little better and this and that, but I never quite understood what Grace was doing that made her so good. I do know she had the ability to throw herself, to believe that she was in a place. I did a Twilight Zone with Uta Hagen, who was a wonderful acting teacher, and she, in her book, talks a lot about how important it is for the actress to really visualize the place. And I think Grace just did that naturally. We were rehearsing. We had this huge rehearsal area, and we were rehearsing some scene where the guy gets her to come outside so we can neck with her, right? He wakes her up in the bedroom and makes her come outside. And she came out just in the rehearsal room. And I felt this girl is feeling the wind blow on her hair. She's hearing the tree frogs. You're rehearsing the scene where she looks out the car window and sees a dog, and there's no dog there because, you know, you're shooting her. What do you need the dog for? But I can see that she is seeing the dog, you know. Bob De Niro came in. And just we were seeing actors in the Warwick Hotel in New York for, I don't know, 8 weeks for Bang the Drum Slowly. We saw every young actor. We saw, you know, everybody, just everybody around New York. But Treat Williams and James Woods and John Lithgow and Bob Balaban. And I mean, but De Niro came in I didn't know who he was, and he just came in to read. And it was a scene where he's standing on a balcony with his roommate, and he's chewing tobacco, and he's spitting. And he's saying, curveball, as he watches the spit fall, or slider, fastball. And the first thing that caught my eye about De Niro was he followed the trajectory of spit with his eyes. He saw it curveball. And I thought, oh, wake up. You know, when you see actors every 15 minutes all day, week after week, you don't sleep, but and you kind of try to approach it with hope, but you really don't. You're there just to you know, to witness or something. I mean, so those moments where suddenly somebody wakes you up, I thought, oh, this guy, oh, pay attention to this one. And he claims I read him six times. Because I didn't need to read him that many times, but we didn't know whether he was playing opposite Michael Moriarty, and we thought, we didn't know which one we wanted to play, the pitcher and which one the catcher, so we tried him in different combinations. And I mean, because De Niro could have played the pitcher and Moriarty the catcher. The catcher was supposed to be blonde, which was Moriarty was, so we were tempted by that, but it, I think we made the right. It would have worked the other way, too. It would have worked, but...
I was happy
with both their performances.
Yeah, you brought us to Bang the Drum Slowly, and this is a film that, you know, I saw when I was a lot younger, and you know, I was young, and I didn't quite understand it. My dad, you know, showed me the film, and it's a movie I grew up with, and I, you know, I think it's absolutely fantastic, and it's one of my favorite baseball movies.
Thank you.
And it's more than just a baseball movie, obviously. It's so many different things, and don't want to spoil this film for people who haven't seen it. Was there ever a question when you were, you know, prepping the film about the sort of like the not necessarily the tonal shift in the film, but you know, it did you see it as a sports film or did you see it more as a human drama, or how did you, you know, what was your in on the material when you first, when you were working on this, you know, the screenplay and everything?
Well, the project had a history. I mean, Robert Altman had tried to get it on with Robert Duvall playing the catcher and Robert Redford playing the pitcher. And they took it to the studios and the studio said, oh, baseball. The idea at that point was that films about baseball didn't make money because, I guess, Pride of the Yankees and Fear Strikes Out had not done that well, you know. But some guys said, baseball and cancer? You know. So there was a whole emphasis around the production office that we're making a human story, not a baseball story. But I always felt, of course, we're making a baseball story. It's also a human story. The one doesn't exclude the other. And I was very, since I wasn't happy with the way baseball had been presented in, I guess, Fear Strikes Out or Pride of the Yankees and that kind of stuff. I wanted to try to do it better. So I spent a lot of time getting the baseball as good as it could be. And we rehearsed it for 4 weeks in New York, and every morning we had baseball school in Central Park and a kind of ex-major leaguer taking them through their paces. And then in the afternoon, we would rehearse the scenes. And that was 5 days a week for 4 weeks. So De Niro had never played baseball, by the way. And, of course, actors, if you ask them, you can play baseball, right? Oh, of course, right. He was honest. He said, no, but I'm very athletic and I can learn. And he did. He kept after it while we were shooting. After we'd shoot a, you know, 11 or 12 hour day, and then he'd go take 2 or 3 hours of batting practice, and then he'd go for a 3 mile run, and then he'd learn his lines for the next day. He said to me, you know, there are more talented actors, but no one will ever work harder. And certainly at that point, and I think still that's true. I mean, he said there's a lot of luck in acting. And then who gets ahead? And somebody said to him, well, but how about how hard you work? He said, well, I'm lucky in being able to work that hard. You know, I thought that was smart. He's very smart. He's really smart.
What was it? And Michael Moriarty is one of the more underrated actors of his generation. I mean, obviously he's had, you know, he certainly got acclaim and, you know, a lot of people love him, but he really is was a fantastic actor. And I think his performance in the movie is great. And what was it like working with him? Cause he really is. He's one of those great actors that I wish like more people knew by name. I feel like, you know, so.
I do too. I'm in touch with him now on Facebook. He's trying to do a modern version of Lear. and we're talking about that. I hope he manages to finish the script, but I was closer to Bobby during the shoot, but Michael and I always got along, and I admired him, liked him. He's not quite as accessible as De Niro to a director. De Niro forms a very close bond with the director, as you can tell by him and Marty or whoever, right? But Michael was not the out kiddie in that either. I mean, he certainly held his own. It was unclear to the crew who was going to be the star. There were the members of the company that were on the Moriarty team, and then the other ones on the De Niro team. And he wasn't, you know, certainly not destined for stardom at that point, De Niro, you know.
I wanted to ask you about Vincent Gardenia and how you directed him to an Oscar-nominated performance for the film. I've always loved him, and I've always thought he was one of the most underrated actors from that generation, and I want to know what it was like working with him.
He didn't need any directing. He'd done so much theater around New York, you know, first Italian theater, and then, I'd seen him, I think I saw him do Endgame off Broadway, and I'd tried to cast him a number of times in my regional theater companies or in things I'd done in New York, but he was always busy with something else, so it never happened. But then I finally got to work with him on Bang That I'm Slowly, and his timing, he didn't need a director. And I was happy. The way I'm the happiest is I just stand there by the camera and I think, oh, that's awfully good. I hope it doesn't go away, you know? I'm kind of a fan in that way. Obviously sometimes you have to really step in and straighten out problems, or if people get going at each other and you have to settle differences and that kind of thing to some degree. But mainly, I think it's just nice if it goes well. The kind of director that says, you know, I got in, I broke her down, I really made that performance, and I just, you know, maybe I destroyed her personally, but I got the part out of her. I never buy that. I always think that ends up a mess. And that you kid yourself. You think by breaking down this person's resistances, you've managed to see into their heart. And there's cruelty. You know, there's a certain amount of cruelty in directing, right? But to me, that's tips over into too much cruelty. And I've done that, but I don't think it works that well. You do better shutting up a little bit and just encourage, you know, you got this, you can do this, that kind of thing, rather than a direct assault on their character armor or something, you know.
Yeah. When did you, because you're directing a sort of span, you know, multiple mediums. When did you decide that you wanted to direct movies? Did it hit you like one day, or was there something that just, you know?
Oh, I always did. I always had that somewhere in my mind, how wonderful, you know, because of just seeing movies as a kid. And, you know, you see Lawrence of Arabia and you think, oh boy.
So you were a buff before you became a filmmaker yourself.
I was a what?
A film buff before you became a filmmaker.
Yeah, sure, yeah. And, yeah. And the things I did in the theater were to some degree filmic. I mean, if you do a lot, Shakespeare is you know, so many scenes and so much movement. There's a kind of film structure in that, and in Brecht too. I did a lot of Brecht, and in a way, Brecht was a playwright that was influenced by movies quite a bit. So, I discovered that it's very similar directing in stage and directing movies. It's technically very much different, and the, where you work and how much you get paid is different, and in films you can hire your first or second choice actors, and often in the theater you're hiring, you know, your eighth or tenth choice actor. But what you do is very similar. You're trying to decide what's clear. You're trying to decide if this is funny or not, and you're trying to get the most out of a group of people, and to make the audience feel. I mean, it's the essential, the center of what you do in the two areas is so similar that it took me a while to learn about lenses and that kind of thing. So I was maybe not as fast as guys as other film directors, but I eventually did. And I teach now. I'm teaching at Columbia College Chicago, and also there's a new film school, the Harold Ramis Film School at Second City in Chicago.
I went to Columbia College, not to cut you off.
You did?
Yes, sir.
Well, there you are. And I'm looking forward to Second City, too, because I think that it'll be interesting to see how you can improvise and also hit marks and that kind of thing. I mean, the whole Second City tradition, I think, has a lot. You know, once you've gone to digital and you haven't got dollars just racing through the magazine and through the camera, it opens up, the possibility of much more improvisation. And as long as you don't improvise too much and end up with more footage than you can make sense of in the editing room. But I'm looking forward to dealing with people from Second City and trying to see how much improvisation can be brought into feature film work.
Since you have directed both stage and screen, and you talked about the similarities and the differences a bit, which is the amount of pressure as a director the same?
Yeah, it is. It's very, very similar. I know the key to both is don't let them make you work 6 day weeks. Because you don't recover your sanity. I mean, the big problem in directing is perspective and how to see something over and over and not lose your perspective and not go mad. Those 2 days off are really valuable, and they tend to want to take them away from you in the theater, and also if you're on location in films. Working in Los Angeles, you work a 5 day week, but if everybody's on per diem, they want you to shoot a 6 day week. But I managed to learn how to resist this. You'd say I don't think I can do a good job, and nobody's willing to say, well then don't, you know. nobody has the balls to say, well, I don't care, don't then. So if you're willing to refuse to do the things that you don't think you can do well, you have a lot of power as a director. Not on television. On television, it's entirely different than directing a feature film. You have to set your dial up to a whole different setting because you're working for them. You're working for the executive producer, and if you want to,
Did you enjoy working on the various shows, you know, like Hill Street Blues?
Yes,
and...
yes, I like them because you shoot fast, and the casts are often good, and the material, I mean, I liked Hill Street a lot because the material was very good, and the cast was good. And we shot them fast, and I was, you know, sometimes you shoot episodic shows and they're more fun to do than they are to see. But that's not good. You should also like to see it. And I did. I was proud of my work on Hill Street. Also the Twilight Zones I was happy with.
Yeah, what was it like working on the Twilight Zone?
Well, this was the remake of Twilight Zone. These were not the original. So, well, it depended. It depended on what, on, you know, I did a bunch of them. So it depended on the script for that. They were, you know, 20-minute segments, three in an hour. And you were no running characters, so you cast each one, and that was advantageous. And I liked the DPs. I had wonderful ADs. I liked Phil DeGuerre, who was the series runner. I was happy doing those. I like to work. I really enjoy directing, and I enjoyed doing things.
I'm sort of shocked that the Twilight Zone has not, of late, has not gotten some sort of like newfangled 2016 reboot, you know, for the small screen. It's like it almost screams like Netflix at this point, like how Netflix has jumped into the, you know, the scripted programming, and they just seemingly have an unending amount of money that they're pouring into all these productions and now feature films. The Twilight Zone is timeless. You know, that's actually one thing I don't mind seeing a remake of, to be honest, or like a continuation or a reboot. It'd be kind of fun.
Well, yeah,
I felt that the structure that people didn't want to see three separate things. Now, why with Rod Sterling did they want to see several things, and with Phil DeGuerre did they resist seeing several things in an hour? Maybe because there was something really unifying and very serious about Rod Serling that made it not, I mean, he was really committed to what he was doing in a way, you know? I mean, he had a dark streak that maybe brought it into the same world in a way that the ones that Phil DeGuerre was developing, they didn't reinforce each other. You know, I did that California Dreaming, right? And it had like several sets of characters and several plot lines. And in that kind of thing, I was conscious watching, you know, I test my stuff with a lot of screenings. I have a lot of screenings in the process of editing and polishing things. And I would feel, you move from one set of another of characters to another, I would feel the audience. Oh, I would feel the tension in the room sag for a moment. Then you could catch them again. But there's something about not wanting to shift stories and storylines that... now, I mean, it can be... Other people have made it work spectacularly. I mean, Last Picture Show or... I mean, a lot of things. But I found that hard in California Dreaming, and I think why don't they remake Twilight Zone? Maybe because people don't want to see three separate stories in an hour.
It almost seems like now would be a prime opportunity, like Nick was saying, bring it back on Netflix, considering the revival of the X-Files and now Twin Peaks next year, which... I mean, I think that the Twilight Zone is a direct inspiration to those two.
You know, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure it would work if they got good writers and did them well. Yeah.
Right.
You need a dark spirit of some kind. You need somebody, you know.
Or do this like a half hour. You know, each episode's a half hour and one story, and then you know, do 60 of them or something. But we definitely
want. That's right. You don't have to have three in an hour, right?
Yeah, no, yeah. I don't think so. But we got to definitely talk about Let's Scare Jessica to Death, because this is a movie that is has a big following. People love it. Were you prepared when you were making the movie, or when you were making Let's Scare Jessica to Death, did you ever get the sense that the film would have the longevity that it has?
No, I didn't realize that. it was a job that, I mean, I had done that short that was nominated, and William Wyler's daughter, Kathy Wyler, recommended me to B.S. Moss Enterprises. Charles Moss Sr. and Charles Moss Jr. were owned the best theater in New York, on Broadway and 42nd, and a whole chain of theaters, and they had up the down the East Coast. Actually, Charlie still does, but they wanted to make a scary film, and they gave me a script that was a parody of a scary film, and I didn't want to do a parody. I wanted to do a scary film. So I said, I'll do this if I can rewrite it and make it scary. And they said, sure. So that's what I did. I looked at a lot of Hitchcock before I did it. I got a 60-millimeter projector and borrowed a whole bunch of prints of different Hitchcock pictures and studied them back and forth in my living room.
Were you a horror movie fan at all, or like a fan of the genre before you took this job?
Was I a fan of horror movies?
Or is that what any, you know, that, yeah.
I liked The Rue Morgue. I liked The Mask of the Red Death. I liked some of those. I liked Roger Corman, very mixed director, but I did like The Mask of the Red Death a lot. I thought it transcended the. It had feeling in excess of horror. It had a kind of tragic quality to it that I liked a lot.
And that's one of the things about Let's Scare Jessica to Death that's cool is that, you know, I'm personally not a big horror movie fan. I'm very selective with the horror movies that I watch. Let's Scare Jessica to Death is actually probably one of the earliest horror movie memories that I have. Was a film that I saw on television a lot when I was growing up. And even just rewatching it not too long ago, I was reminded about how, you know, I don't want to spoil it again. We never want to do spoilers on our show, but it's the most unique vampire movie that you're ever going to see, or one of them at least, certainly. When filmmakers juggle tone and when they try to have more than just one thing going on in any given moment, I'm a big fan of that, and I think that's one of the reasons
why.
That's my
principal interest. I mean, that's what I like about Bang the Drum Slowly is the way it moves from being funny to very sad and back to funny. And I mean, I like the an ambiguous tone or a double tone. And I mean, that seems to me very much like life. And
yeah, absolutely. I've always thought that
one of the
way.
Big influences on Jessica was a Robert Wise film, The Haunting.
Classic stuff there.
They're making really good horror films now, boy. I thought Babadook and the Ring, and I mean, they're making very scary films now that I like a lot.
Oh, I love, yeah. I still haven't seen Babadook yet, but I'm a massive fan of The Ring. I mean, that movie still creeps me out to this day.
Me too. It's too scary almost. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
What now that you mention that, what horror films have you seen recently? Have you seen like The Witch or It Follows or Don't Breathe or any of
None.
The more recent ones? Yeah, because I'm along the same lines with Nick where I'm very selective, but I feel within the past couple years that they've actually put out some pretty frightening films. And I'm with you guys. I mean, The Ring kind of fucked me up when I saw it for the first time. I mean, in all honesty, that left an impression on me. And the first Blair Witch Project left a huge impression on me.
Yeah. It's funny you brought both of those up because in both instances, for The Ring and for Blair Witch, I had a chance to see both of those movies at like, you know, 3 or 4 month early test screening type deals. One of them being in California, The Ring, and actually one of them, the Blair Witch actually one was probably a month early. It probably wasn't 3 or 4 months. The Ring was early. They did a long lead, like publicity screening of Blair Witch in Connecticut. And I remember seeing it and I remember people just freaking out in the theater. I mean, just like losing their shit. And the same thing with The Ring. I mean, I would say that those two, for in my lifetime, I didn't, you know, see Jaws, for instance, in the theater. I didn't see Alien in the theater. Wasn't born yet, but actually, Alien came out in 1980, so I guess I was born. I don't know, something like that. But in any event, not being a huge horror movie person, those two movies, certainly that Frank, The Ring and Blair Witch, those certainly stand out to me as two of the more genuinely frightening modern horror films.
Did they make a lot of changes in The Ring between what you saw and when it opened?
As to the best of my memory, with The Ring and what I saw in that test screening and then what was released in the theaters, I do not remember anything being massively different or...
That's interesting. Yeah,
I do not remember seeing anything majorly different at all. In fact, I want to say that when we saw The Ring, there were still a couple of shots they hadn't finished, and it had like those black inserts. And they told us beforehand, you know, like there'd be a couple of spots. So, but no, nothing major from a plot standpoint. You know, it's the imagery of that girl coming out of the TV, man. It's like, it's still that, against that, her. It's just, yeah.
that was there. Huh? It would be a pity to see the film without that shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I want to touch on a couple other things if we can. One film that you made, which is another movie I saw when I was younger, and it really needs to get a proper release, a disc release or something, is Weeds with Nick Nolte, Nolte is just one of my favorite actors of all time. I love, and this is a great performance, and it's like, you know, when they write the book on Nick Nolte, somebody better, you know, write a good chapter on Weeds, because it's one of the more unsung performances of his, you know, frankly, legendary career.
We were very proud of that and had a wonderful time doing it with him, and it was a good experience. They've lost the negative. Somehow, you know, Dino went out of business in the middle of the release.
Oh, that's and, right. That's the
Just, no one knows where the negative is. Now, I have DVDs I made from my laser disc, and you could do a DVD release from that, and I wish somebody would. But they can't figure out who owns it. You know, so it's how do you...
Nobody knows literally... Who owns the rights to the film?
Can't. It's what they say is, well, it's one of those pictures that's in limbo, and we can't determine the rights. I know the solution to that. When I first started in the theater, my mentor was Eric Bentley, who published, I don't know, five or six collections of European plays from the last 100 years, right? And the rights in all of those were tangled up. They were, you know, the heirs that weren't getting along and the translator and, you know. He just went ahead and published them. He didn't have the rights. He just went ahead and published them. And then if somebody complained, he paid him some money. And maybe he got sued once or twice and settled. But I think that's kind of what you have to do with a picture like if you want to put out Weeds. You have to just say, okay, well, here I'm going to put it out, and if at some point Universal comes and says hey, and shows you some papers to say they own it, then you pay them some money.
Well, it's one of those movies that, like, you know, Kino Lorber or Shout Factory, you know, like one of those,
right?
One of those,
right?
You know, it really screams Kino Lorber, to be honest with you, just in terms of their overall catalog and what Weeds is all about. We should figure this out. We should get on this, get a petition going.
Yeah. Good.
So you mentioned that you love to stay busy, love to, you know, keep working. Currently coming up, you're doing, you said, the Second City, and you have also some, well, the other, you're teaching. Can you tell us a little bit about
But I've got a project I'm trying to get on about Putzi Hampfstengel, who was Hitler's piano player and close friend, and who made the mistake of telling Hitler what he thought. and that went very badly. And so Putzi had to get his family out of Germany. And it's a lot of action, you know, chases in the Alps, and you know, it's kind of a high. It's an action picture about a guy who realizes that he's his life has taken a terrible turn that he needs to make up for. He ended up advising Roosevelt on how to beat the Nazis. He managed to get out and help the Allies win the war.
Wow, this is
because he had
awesome.
Inside information on all of the top Nazis, because they were his social friends, you know.
And this is something that you're working, that you're writing right now, or have
written? It's written.
Or...
It's written, and I'm trying to. I'm CIA is trying to help me package it.
Oh wow!
Wow, because awesome. That does sound like something that would be quite cinematic to see,
yeah,
and certainly
yeah.
a story. I can't. I mean, I certainly didn't know nothing about, you know, this. I don't even want to try to pronounce this guy's name that you just said. I don't think I could say it right. But I certainly did not know about Hitler's piano player.
Big goofy guy. Big, you know, genial, charming German aristocrat, Munich, you know, Bavarian. Everybody liked him, except the people kind of thought he was an asshole.
Interesting.
So it's nice
wow.
that he then finally, you know, the asshole becomes heroic somehow. I like it. It's a good story. Got to cast it right.
Wow. Yeah, it was just when you were saying that, I was like, I had visions of like Will Ferrell or like Zach Galifianakis or something, like somebody genial who could play an asshole and then never
yeah,
come up
yeah.
and spit. That's oh okay. I was gonna say maybe that's not the way you would want to go with this, but
no, that's perfect for it. Yeah.
Well, let's hope that this project happens, because that sounds like a movie that I would definitely want to see for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
yeah same too. Here. That sounds great.
But thank you very much for chatting with us about
this, guys. I enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, and everybody check out The Looking Glass on Netflix. You can pick it up on disc as well. It's a very nice movie. Definitely check it out. And thank you again, John, for coming and
right.
speaking
Thank
to us
and having.